Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Foreign Service was created in 1924 to leave foreign relations to nonpartisan professionals who are trained in the arts and skills that tend to lead to ambassadorships. Americans got a rare glimpse of the inner workings of that world last fall during the House impeachment inquiry. Now, last week's American drone strike that killed an Iranian military leader and nine others in Iraq. In Iraq has shifted the focus of U.S. foreign relations to the Middle East. Ohio State professor Jennifer Siegel teaches U.S. diplomatic history. She joins us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Anne. I actually teach European diplomatic history.
I see. Okay.
But and, the U.S., of course, is a key diplomatic partner of Europe. So.
Okay. And veteran diplomatic correspondent Paul Richter has written a new book on the topic. It is titled The Ambassadors, America's Diplomats on the Front Lines. Welcome to the show, Paul Richter.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
This show, Paul, was originally scheduled for after the impeachment inquiry in the House when we got that rare glimpse of how the State Department operates. And now we appear to be on the brink of war with Iran. And I'm wondering, given the focus of the Middle East on your book, how does the role of the diplomat come into play in this scenario in the Middle East?
Well, obviously, if the Iranians and the Americans decide that they want to head toward a diplomatic settlement, the diplomats will be key in working that out. And I noticed that George Bush's national security advisor, Steve Hadley, today in the Washington Post urges the two sides to move toward a diplomatic solution. But I don't sense that either side really seems to be particularly moving in that direction at the moment. Certainly the Iranians are talking about retribution at this point.
What was the diplomatic situation in the region or between Iran and the U.S. before these latest hostilities in the last few weeks? Did they have a regular pipeline of communication?
Well, there's been behind the scenes communications really on and off since the revolution. No administration likes to talk about this too much, but it's gone on intermittently throughout. In recent months, of course, the U.S. and the Iranians have been increasingly at odds because the U.S. has been continuing to impose and police tough sanctions that have done a lot of damage to the Iranian economy. So things have been getting increasingly tense.
And the world is getting increasingly smaller. So it's not surprising, Jennifer Siegel, that the European diplomatic corps is on high alert as well, right?
Absolutely. This is a classic example of the entangled ways that diplomatic relations actually are conducted. I think that what Paul was just highlighting about the ways in which communication has been ongoing despite the formal blockage of ties between Iran and the United States is absolutely in keeping with the ways in which diplomacy across the lines of both alliances and between allies and between enemies takes mm-hmm. place. There's a long tradition of those kinds of back channels between enemies or potential enemies, the use of third parties as
intermediaries or something
exactly.
like that. And I'm thinking when I was reading your book, Paul, I got a very strong sense of that you were talking about, you focus on four particular diplomats who had most of their work was in the Middle Eastern region, but they, it's not all gilt dining rooms and red carpets, as I don't know if it was you or somebody else said. They're often going to warlords and talking with them. They're not. It's not as formal and as fussy necessarily.
Right. The people that I write about in my book are people who essentially became specialists in working in the toughest places in the Middle East in the decade and a half after the 9/11 attacks. And for them, they're constantly under danger. They're constantly having to deal with chaotic situations, and it's a tough gig.
Do they tend to, those tougher gigs, do they tend to be the career diplomats in those places?
Well, typically, it's not the, you know, rich donors who are assigned to places like Baghdad and Islamabad. It's the career diplomats, because they're not, you know, they're not grand, they're not luxurious. But these people are happy to do it. I mean, there's a breed of these people that really enjoys being in the toughest places, and they feel they're contributing.
Of course, the United States is really an outlier in the number of political appointees that it places throughout the world.
That's not typical.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's no other foreign country relies on the amateur for any of their frequency of placements in ambassador positions and high level senior positions, both around the world and also within the State Department itself. This is not the norm in the rest of the world's diplomatic corps.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about diplomacy around the world. Right now, there's a couple of hot spots, as we know, and we're a little bit focused on that, but it in the Middle East, it has long been an important issue, particularly since 9/11. And Paul Richter, in his new book, focuses on four diplomats in the Middle East or in the region since 9/11. He's a veteran diplomatic correspondent. His book is titled The Ambassadors, America's Diplomats on the Front Lines. Also with us is OSU historian Jennifer Siegel. She teaches 19th and 20th century European diplomatic and military history at Ohio State. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Paul Richter, how big, you know, I guess a lot of people are just sort of zeroing in on the diplomatic corps right now because of the impeachment proceedings and that sort of a thing, and because of what's happened in Ukraine. But how much different really is the Trump administration from, let's say, the last four or five?
They've leaned more heavily on the non-career figures to take senior diplomatic posts. Typically, administrations will have about one-third of their ambassadors be non-career people, be political appointees, and with the Trump administration, it's up to between 45% and 50%. They've moved it around. I mean, President Trump and his senior people, they don't have the same kind of regard for the career diplomatic service. They see them more often as, the diplomatic establishment that they want to shake up. They want to disrupt so many things. And this is one of them. They think that they can put in people from other backgrounds, people from political backgrounds, and have the same or a better effect than these career people who've been doing it a long time. So it's a different attitude.
Now, there have been defenders within the administration, but they don't last long, right?
Defenders
of the State Department, of the diplomatic corps.
Well, yes. The case of Ambassador Yovanovitch is kind of an example of somebody who had the traditional outlook of career diplomats and wanted to follow what's been U.S. policy on Ukraine for some time. But Rudy Giuliani and others in the president's inner circle had a much different view of what should be happening in Ukraine. And she was quickly pushed out.
To what extent should we expect the Trump administration to turn to diplomats, to turn to those career diplomats and career State Department personnel for guidance in the situation regarding Iran? I mean, do we know, Paul Richter, if they're part of anything going on there right now?
There is certainly a presence of career diplomats in this situation. Matt Tuller, who's the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, is a long time U.S. career diplomat, and he worked for one of the principal characters in my book, Ryan Crocker, in Iraq. So he's been around a long time. And there are a number of senior people in the diplomatic apparatus who've been around for a long time as Mideast specialists. And Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, has brought in people with that kind of background. But in the most important positions, on the most important decisions, it's really the president and his inner circle who decide these things, and they don't turn often to the old timers.
So then, Jennifer Siegel, where historically does that leave the likes of the European, you know, and the rest of the world's diplomatic corps?
I think that part of the problem is that lower strata of the way in which diplomatic relations takes place. It's not just at the highest echelons of the state. And those kinds of communications that exist in what are very tight-knit diplomatic communities stationed in foreign lands, for example, is absent when there is not the same kind of an ongoing presence of a career foreign service community from the United States.
So they're seeing the United States, the people at those lower echelons, but nevertheless important in their way, are seen as less reliable.
They're seen as less reliable. They are my sense is that the personnel is really has really changed. Many people have left the Foreign Service. That there is much less of a reliance on those people within the State Department. Those who have chosen to remain there feeling increasingly sidelined, and this makes it very difficult to conduct for the United States to really. Play to its weight, to throw its weight around in the international community when those expected forms of interaction are much less reliable.
We're going to continue our conversation. That's Jennifer Siegel. She's a professor of 19th and 20th century European diplomatic and military history at Ohio State. Also with us, a veteran diplomatic correspondent and author of a new book. It's titled The Ambassadors, America's Diplomats on the Front Lines, Paul Richter. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The American drone strike that killed an Iranian military leader and nine others in Iraq last week has shifted the focus of U.S. foreign relations to the Middle East once again. But still on the back burner is the issue of diplomacy with Ukraine in light of the impeachment of President Trump. Still with us is Ohio State historian Jennifer Siegel. She focuses on diplomatic history, primarily 19th and 20th century European diplomatic and military history at OSU. And veteran diplomatic correspondent Paul Richter. His new book is titled The Ambassadors, America's Diplomats on the Front Lines. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Paul, you wrote in a November opinion piece that American diplomats around the globe were thrilled to see State Department employees like the former ambassador Marie Yovanovitch testifying in the Ukraine scandal and coming off as patriots and heroes. But you also cautioned that this public acclaim is probably fleeting. Why is that?
Well, the Foreign Service has always had a public relations problem. The American public doesn't see them much, doesn't understand very well what they do. And they're more often seen and depicted in the movies as people who go to fancy parties and in evening dress and enjoy themselves overseas when that's not really the case. I mean, the other members of the American team overseas, the military and the intelligence agencies, it's much harder for ordinary Americans to grasp what they do. But the diplomats are out there and they're working for the U.S. and average citizens in a lot of ways. They're taking care of them when they're overseas. They're working to promote U.S. Export U.S. businesses overseas. They're even working to protect the U.S. against various contagious diseases. There's a lot of things they do. I've been talking on and off to the Foreign Service Union, and they say they'd like to take advantage of this period to kind of publicize what it is that the diplomatic corps does. But they've got to start, you know, from ground zero, because the Foreign Service is simply not well known or understood.
It's kind of like it was compared to the military in a review I saw your book. They compared the Foreign Service to the military in their approach, that who's ever at the top calls the shots and they go with it, and or they leave if they don't agree. And a lot, that's hard for a lot of people to understand. It's similar with journalism. When I was reading about that, it made me, you know, at least the good journalism is that you just report what's going on and you don't take sides. It is a curious notion to a lot of people, but I'm trying to think about, I read that you have been talking to the union about that, and I'm wondering what sort of tack are they even going to take? They certainly don't want to rely on scandals in Ukraine to elevate it, right?
Well, they're just going to try to mount a kind of consciousness-raising campaign so that Americans appreciate their job. You know, the military has a lot of supporters in Congress, and big military installations provide a lot of jobs all over the U.S., and so they have kind of built-in advocates all over the country in Congress, and the diplomats have never really had that kind of public support. And when they get into trouble, as during the McCarthy period, when there's negative publicity about them, then it's much harder for them to defend themselves. And Congress finds it much easier to cut funds for the State Department and add to them, because there's not political advocacy for giving more money to diplomats.
And I think it's important to remember that the tradition in the United States since its inception has been that foreign policy has been in the hands of, in the domain of, the diplomats, that it has not been in the United States the military who have been setting the foreign policy agenda, who have been at the front lines of the pursuit of that foreign policy once it is actually set, stretching back to Benjamin Franklin, our first diplomat, who was sent to France at the very start of the nation. It has been the diplomats who have been at the wheel of American foreign policy. It's only relatively recently that the military has come to the fore at the center of foreign policy, not just military policy, not just security policy, and it is, you know, very much so in keeping with the American tradition that it is the diplomats, that it is the somewhat modern form of diplomats in this professionalized foreign service community that it's those are the people who
are driving
driving foreign policy.
When I was, you know, reading your book, Paul Richter, I saw photographs of a diplomat. He was flanked by a U.S. general, and on the other side, a leader. I can't remember if it was Afghanistan or Iraq or what it was. But what about the relationship between the military and our diplomats in the Middle East these days?
Right. Well, in this period since 9/11, we've been in, it's been really kind of a historically anomalous situation, I think, because we've been embroiled in a lot of wars and revolutions and counterinsurgencies in the greater Middle East And the U.S. military has had much more of a presence than they usually do, and the intelligence agencies, too. And so it's been a situation where the top diplomats and the top generals have tried to work together. And there's been a lot of circumstances when the two didn't get along. They had different views about what the U.S. should be doing. But the military always had a lot of leverage because they had lots more billions of dollars to throw around, and they had tens of thousands of military troops as well under their command. So it's been kind of a military-dominated situation in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, and the diplomats have kind of lamented that. But the question now is whether that'll continue. Americans are really weary of all these long wars, and it may be that the military won't have as much of a presence in the future, assuming that we're not now going to war with Iran.
And then, Jennifer Siegel, how does that changing this trajectory toward more military influence in a place like the Middle East versus diplomatic influence, how does that change then how European leadership manages how they respond to what's going on in the Middle East?
Well, I think that that's an interesting question, and it's not entirely clear how that actually changes the geostrategic situation in the mm-hmm. Middle East and Europe's role going forward. The Europeans are military partners with the United States. They are military allies. They participate in various coalition exercises and operations throughout the world, not just in the Middle East, along with the United States. At the same time, the Europeans are not equal partners with the United States as far as the military goes. They are able to, I think that they feel that they are able to exercise a much greater authority and play a greater role vis-a-vis diplomacy than they are in the military realm. And so it's problematic for the power balance when the primary means of engagement is a military operation as opposed to diplomatic relations.
And then that relationship with the intelligence to Paul Richter. So I'm seeing like two realms here, the intelligence realm and the diplomatic realm, neither of which have been on the good side of President Trump, right?
Well, he's had various differences of opinion with the intelligence agencies as well as with the military brass regularly. Mm. But now you notice in this situation with the attack on Soleimani, the president is relying on what he says the intelligence agencies told him about the threat from Iran.
Right. And then they were the amazing intelligence agency or something like that. It's kind of, yeah. And then these issues, it's considered a war crime to destroy cultural, you know, heritage sites. We've seen what's happened in Syria and, you know, throughout the Middle East, and they've threatened, or the president was directly threatening to do that in Iran. Where does diplomacy come in when it comes to issues like that, Paul Richter?
Well, I mean, it's been kind of a settled view of U.S. officials and other governments that combatants shouldn't go after other countries' cultural sites. There's really no disagreement about that. And President Trump kind of wandered off the reservation on that issue, and now his Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, has clarified yesterday that they're not really going to do that. any diplomat worth his salt would have cautioned the president, and the military leadership knew as well that that's outside the tradition. I mean, the military brass have to spend a lot of time thinking about what the rules of of war are, and say, so they know that it's not considered acceptable to go after other countries' cultural sites.
Jennifer?
Well, and these rules of war have been established in the wake of previous wars and previous violations of what we now consider to be acceptable. I agree with Paul that this was I almost want to say a classic example of Trump going off script or going off the reservation. I very much like that vision. The fact that this was so very quickly walked back by disavowed by the military, who would be those who would be responsible, would be held responsible for that war crime. I found that quite reassuring.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Paul Richter, when you described or enumerated the percentage of political appointees to the diplomatic corps versus non-political or career, one of the things that's happened with this administration is they haven't filled a lot of slots. So it's a little artificially inflated on one side, but on the other side, it's very depleted, is it not?
Yes, there are still a lot of positions that they have not that they have not filled, not only ambassadorial positions, but positions throughout the kind of diplomatic hierarchy in the State Department. And they seem comfortable with that. I mean, they don't, when big decisions are to be made, they're made by the White House inner circle, and there's less reliance on these functionaries. But there's a real loss, I think, for the country in having those people not there, because there's a lot of regular business that needs to be attended to all around the world. And on this issue of what career diplomats do, you know, our adversaries, the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, they wouldn't think of relying on newcomers, on neophytes, to handle these big negotiations overseas. And so, when we're sending in to these arguments, people from non-diplomatic backgrounds, we're really going in kind of ill-equipped for the fight.
I can't remember if it was the article you wrote or the in November or not, Paul, but you or somebody made the observation that applications for jobs in Foreign Service have dropped from, I think, 20,000 typical of around 20,000 average in previous years to about 8,000 last year. I mean, is there something going through the pipeline that's informing students of foreign affairs that this isn't the place to go?
Right. There's a lot of concern about people who've been thinking about a foreign affairs career, about whether, you know, what the role of the Foreign Service is going to be going forward, and will it be diminished? If President Trump gets another term, he's likely to continue along the same path. He's deeply skeptical about the career diplomats and more inclined to use political people that he appoints to big jobs. So there has been a real drop in the number of young people who are taking the Foreign Service exam. The peak was about 20,000 in around 2010,
okay,
and last year it was about 8,000. But it's important to also point out that there are still a lot of young people who are really, really interested in this kind of career. I know a couple of professors at International Relations School, and they say that they still see a lot of young people who are just dying to get into the Foreign Service. It's just a difficult time to figure out what's going to happen with your career if you do go that route.
And yeah, I mean, that's true, but I would love to go into the Foreign Service, but I don't think I could pass their exam from what I understand. And Jennifer Siegel, as far as the long-term prospects, it takes years to work your way up the food chain there, right? And probably for good reason. It's complicated.
It's not just a question of working your way up the food chain. It's a question of the kind of training that goes into becoming a specialist. It's one of the things that is so extraordinary about a professional diplomatic corps and foreign service corps, that these are people who are area specialists, who are subject specialists, who have the kind of training plus the experience that comes from the years spent working one's way up that food chain to be able to accomplish what it is that the nation wants to be accomplishing. And we are absolutely damaging not just the present day functionality of the Foreign Service, but for
20
years
hence,
to come.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And Paul Richter, you know, the challenge, you know, the obstacles, or I'm trying to think the hurdles it takes to get into the Foreign Service is they're great because it is a complicated job. They want the best of the best. You make that point that, in fact, the four people you sort of focus on in your book are the best of the best in the worst of the worst situations.
Yes. These people were sent in repeatedly as ambassadors to these really tough countries in the Middle East, in the greater Middle East, because they kind of proved themselves over and over again. And the reason why I got into this book was because I saw that the senior people in the State Department continued to pick these same four people over and over again whenever there was an important job to take on. They really do kind of get, you know, they develop an expertise in this over time.
We're going to talk more about Paul Richter's book coming up. For now, I have to say thank you and goodbye to Jennifer Siegel. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me here, Anne.
Jennifer Siegel, professor of 19th and 20th century European diplomatic and military history at Ohio State. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the role of diplomacy leading up to and in the age of the Trump administration. Still with us is veteran diplomatic correspondent Paul Richter. His new book is titled The Ambassadors, America's Diplomats on the Front Lines. If you have a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Paul, you focus on four, well, they're in your cast of characters, and you lead off with them, Ryan Crocker, Robert Ford, Ann Patterson, and J. Christopher Stevens. And he was the diplomat who was killed in the terrorist attack on the U.S. diplomatic mission in Benghazi in 2012. It's been turned into a political football, obviously, by way of Hillary Clinton. Tell us about him and what it was about him that stood out.
Well, Chris Stevens was an interesting guy. He'd originally been a Peace Corps volunteer in Morocco, and he really enjoyed simply making new friends and learning the details of these foreign cultures. He tried to learn Arabic, which is really a tough language. He was a diplomat who had misgivings about the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, and he was asked a couple of times to go and serve in Iraq, and he didn't want to because he thought that would be a highly militarized situation where his skills wouldn't be as badly needed as those of the military guys. But it turned out that it wasn't because he was reluctant to face danger, because he agreed to go into Libya when their civil war broke out in 2011. He sneaked in on a Greek cargo ship under a NATO bombardment at the time, and he stayed in Benghazi, Libya, for the duration of the civil war there. And then he went back the following year in 2012 to become U.S. ambassador to Libya after the civil war was, we thought, winding down. Stevens made a decision to go out to eastern Libya, to Benghazi, in September. And it was a mistake because it turned out that the militant groups were really becoming violently anti-American. And he was killed when they attacked the U.S. mission there in Benghazi.
These people have targets on their back all the time in these places. Ann Patterson lived in her office for a year after she was there was an attempted assassination, right?
She faced risks wherever she went. You know, she was earlier the ambassador to Colombia, and there was a car bomb. Went off as her motorcade was passing on one trip. When she was in Pakistan, the situation got more tense all the time, and there had been times in the past when mobs had attacked U.S. facilities. There was one case when the U.S. embassy personnel had to rush into a safe room because a mob was attacking and basically burning the embassy down. So the risks are constant there. There have been more U.S. diplomats killed overseas than American generals. It's always been a tough job, and it's become more risky in recent decades. In the old days, militant groups that didn't like America wouldn't set out to assassinate U.S. diplomats, but in recent years, they've been explicit that they wanted to kill them. There was a U.S. ambassador in Yemen, with the local Al Qaeda affiliate, offered 6 pounds of gold to anybody who could get to him.
Yeah, you wrote that since 2001, there have been more than 400 significant attacks on U.S. diplomatic facilities and personnel. That's from the Bureau of Diplomatic Security. Does that have an impact on people's willingness to move around in the field?
It does. I mean, a lot of the senior Foreign Service people signed up for the Foreign Service at a time when there wasn't this kind of risk, and they weren't expecting to have to be, you know, quasi-commandos mm-hmm. when they signed up for this career. And some of them have had misgivings. Now, on the other hand, there are also people like Robert Ford who went into the business not thinking he'd be facing all this risk. But he kept going back time and again. He signed up for 5 tours in Iraq during its worst years. And then he went to Syria as ambassador, and then its civil war broke out. And Robert Ford had to try to deal with Syria's problems in that war for a couple of years. After that, he was offered a post in a quiet part of Asia, and he and his wife discussed it, and Robert decided that, you know, this was going to be too dull for him. He'd become used to, the world of car bombs and rocket attacks.
You know, and then I'm thinking about Chris Stevens again, you know, going over on a Greek fishing boat or whatever it was to Libya. How do they operate under those circumstances? He sneaks into the country. What's his status?
This was a really unusual situation. The State Department usually doesn't send envoys to rebel groups. We had official relations with the Libyan government of Muammar Gaddafi, so it was really highly irregular to have this envoy to go over and deal with the rebels. But the people in the State Department decided, and the White House decided that, you know, we had a role in this civil war. We agreed to try to protect the rebels from a mass slaughter by Gaddafi. And so we needed to know who these rebels were, who the leadership was, what their plans were. And so the State Department decided they needed somebody like Stevens to go over and figure out what was up. And that's the role that these people play. You know, they advise presidents, secretaries of state on local customs, local attitudes and plans. And that's kind of their greatest value is explaining what's going on in the in foreign societies and providing advice and then dealing with foreign leaders like these rebels who can be very difficult to deal with. And in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, the local leadership wants to work with the Americans, but they have very, very different goals. And so the ambassador's job is to go in and talk to them and try to convince them to do what Washington would prefer.
So how is he protected in a situation like that?
Well, in this situation where Stevens went into Libya, there mm-hmm. wasn't a lot of protection. He went in with a handful of security guys, and then he had to decide where he was going to set up shop. He originally worked out of a hotel in Benghazi, where there were a lot of diplomats, businessmen, and spies. But it became increasingly dangerous as the civil war went on. There was, at one point, he was awakened in the middle of the night and got word that the Washington feared there might be a Scud missile attack on the hotel, and so he had to run down into the basement. One day, a truck bomb went off in the parking lot of the hotel. And so Stevens decided he'd have to move somewhere else in the city. So it was a constant, situation of danger.
What about their families?
In a lot of these places, there's limitations on whether your family can go along. Robert Ford and his wife were both Foreign Service employees, but they worked apart in different parts of the Middle East for many years. I think he told me that he spent about half of his career working in places where his wife was not with him. She was in other postings not far away. When Ann Patterson was ambassador to Pakistan, her husband could not be there all the time. It was a so-called unaccompanied post. But it turns out that her husband was a Foreign Service officer, too, he had been in the past. And so he understood this situation. You know, it goes with the territory in these jobs.
The question of draining the swamp, or the issue of that Donald Trump raised when he was running for president and said that he would pursue when he became president, most people thought it had more to do with the moneyed interest, the lobbyists, and that kind of a thing. But you've written that the State Department employees knew pretty right away that he was talking about them.
Right. The president's view was that there were an establishment, a Washington establishment that was running policy, and it was undermining what presidents like him would want to do. And that's kind of the way he sees it. He believes that a lot of these career people are part of the deep state. They have their own goals that don't square with those of average Americans. And people, some people in the diplomatic corps worried that now that career diplomats came forward in the impeachment hearings to challenge what Trump's inner circle wanted in Ukraine, if he wins another term, he's going to be even more suspicious of the career diplomatic corps, because some of them have openly confronted him.
What about that that relationship, though, because they're supposed to respond to their directives regardless of who's in charge, right?
Right. That's the original plan for the Foreign Service. In 1924, when it was set up, the idea was to have a number of regional specialists, people who knew diplomacy, who knew these areas and the languages, and could advise presidents. And their marching orders are that they're supposed to do whatever the administration wants, whether it's a Democratic or Republican administration. Their view is just to help them implement policy. And that's usually the way it works. Most of the time, Foreign Service officers just do what the administration in power wants them to do. And there's not really a lot of conflict over it. But in some cases recently, there have been cases where the diplomats themselves have misgivings about what the administration is doing. And in some cases, they quit the Foreign Service because they really find that they can't, in good conscience, support what policy the administration is carrying out. One of my diplomats that I write about in my book, Robert Ford, he'd been the ambassador to Syria for a couple of years, and he really felt that the Obama administration should be doing more than it was doing to try to sort out the Syrian civil war. And so in 2014, he told his bosses that he was retiring from the Foreign Service.
You do write about a code of the Foreign Service. What's the code? What is the guiding principle?
Well, it's exactly what I've been saying. In their first introductory class, new Foreign Service entrants are told, your job is to advise whatever administration is in power and to help them decide what policy to take, and then you help them implement that policy, even if you don't personally agree with it. That's been the design of the diplomatic corps from the beginning. And usually that's done without any problem. Mm-hmm. I would say that most diplomats go through their whole career without having a crisis of conscience about what policy the administration their work for is taking. But from time to time there are these disagreements. During the Vietnam War there was some diplomats felt they couldn't in good conscience help carry out that policy. During the Balkans Wars of the 90s, there were diplomats who differed with what President Clinton wanted to do in those years.
We're just about out of time, but is there any kind of underpinning of values to this in concert with following your orders, that, you know, perpetuation of democracy, freedom of speech, that kind of stuff?
Right. Well, most of the
anti-corruption,
people,
most
of the people in the diplomatic corps are kind of foreign policy traditionalists. They believe in kind of the general outlines of the bipartisan foreign policy that's been worked out in the years since World War II. And they're advocates for American internationalism and for America taking a leading role in the world. They're advocates for free markets and free trade and human rights, freedom of speech around the world. I mean, some of the kind of generally accepted principles. But sometimes they find that they're working for presidents who disagree with what the traditional policy of past presidents has been, and that's when there may be a rub.
Paul Richter, thanks so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Glad to do it.
Paul Richter, veteran diplomatic correspondent, author of the book, The Ambassadors, America's Diplomats on the Front Lines. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.